Previously on Beta.
Well, no more Elf today, Daddy.
No beads, no boobs, and no Bourbon Street.
So are you passing on the big box for certain?
Yes.
Tiffany, what's in the big box?
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Jamie Attenberg on writing her memoir after creating 7 books of fiction.
I think of fiction writing as just basically gossiping about characters. So I can do that all day, really, but gossiping about myself is a different story.
And we look back on the Monkees' 1968 feature film, Head.
It was the high point of my whole Monkees experience. And I think it lives on well beyond the television shows, but it lives on like the music lives on.
But first,
I'm on OkCupid, and this guy messaged me. I'm 54, and he goes, 54? Wow, you look 50. Wow, slow down, sir. Let me take a second and accept this amazing compliment that I look 4 years younger. Thank you. You look like you'll never be naked in my garage. He was, but that's not the point of that joke.
That's Laurie Kilmartin. She recently spent 10 years as an Emmy-nominated writer for Conan O'Brien, but Laurie is a stand-up comedy veteran. She started making people laugh in the 1980s, and 40 years later, she's still going strong. But you don't have to take my word for it. Just listen to her latest album, Corset. Laurie has funny takes on single motherhood, dating, and dealing with a live-in mom. She also has an uncanny knack for striking up funny conversations with members of the audience. We caught up with Laurie from her California home to talk about the special, the tragic loss of her mother before its release, and why she called it Corset.
Well, I recorded it in 2019, and at that time, my mother was living with me, and I'm also a single mom, and my son was, I guess he was 12, but, you know, the ages 0 to 12 really suck the life out of you. And I felt like between the two of them, I was being suffocated, much like if I was wearing a corset that had been tied too tight.
So, yeah, and the cover features a photo of you wearing a corset and you're in this body of water. And it turns out that former Beta guest Cristela Alonso helped you with this. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I just thought a corset looked cool. I thought, I like the name, I like the metaphor and all that stuff. And so I just posted a picture of the one I bought on Amazon on Twitter, and I didn't realize it would be difficult to get into. Mm-hmm. And then Cristela DM'd me and was like, I used to do that for a living. And I'm like, wait, that's a job? Putting a corset on people? Oh my God. So she was open the day I was getting my pictures taken, and she came over, and it turned out to be like a 6-hour day, and she got me into it, and she had to get me out of it. If she hadn't chimed in and just offered, I don't know what we would have done. I probably would have just been wearing a t-shirt, and it would have a totally different vibe.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, a corset, you cannot put on a corset yourself. And that made me think that perhaps a corset could be thought of as kind of a straitjacket. Do you see a connection
exactly.
there?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. Believe me. Being bookended by those two, my young son and my old mother, definitely felt like I was in a straitjacket.
Whenever I do have a boyfriend, I never introduce my son to him as a boyfriend. I always say, oh, honey, this is your uncle. And then when I break up with a guy, I tell my son, oh, honey, your uncle died. Yeah, it's tough because once I had a really good month on OkCupid, which means, of course, my son had the worst month of his entire life. Yeah, he lost 11 uncles and 2 aunts. Yeah. And a grandpa. But that guy actually died.
I'm always curious about what a loved one thinks of a comedian's material about them. What does your son think of your comedy?
He doesn't, as far as I know, he doesn't listen to too much of it. Like, pre-pandemic or pre-Omicron, because he's vaxxed, he would come to me with clubs, to clubs, but it was clubs that had cheeseburgers. Like, that was his number one priority. Priority for a comedy club is that to have a cheeseburger. So I'm not sure that he listened too much. I think he might be partially aware of my material, but not really. I don't know. It's weird. I mean, he's sort of grown up with it, so he's used to it.
Yeah, well, he's missing out.
Well, you know, there's some stuff I'm chronicling his life in real time. You know, there's some stuff he can hear later when he's an adult that he doesn't need to hear at the same time he's living it. Mm-hmm. Especially when I'm talking about his grades and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I try to be more positive at home. I'm definitely more negative on stage, and so I wouldn't want him to think I actually feel that way.
My kid, when he was in kindergarten, they had homework in kindergarten. 2 pages a night, and then you turn in a packet of 8 pages on Friday, and it was to teach the kids that life was a series of meaningless chores. And they should have killed themselves in preschool. Okay. So 1 week, I didn't do it with him at all. I just blew it off. I was not having it. And then Thursday night comes, and I was like, oh, God. I either have to do 8 pages with him now, or I could put him to bed, drink a bottle of wine, put the pencil in my non-dominant hand. Right, exactly, like a 5-year-old.
You do some great crowd work throughout Corset. So I'm wondering, when you're recording a comedy album, do you invite these opportunities or avoid them?
I always invite those opportunities. It just, to me, it makes the show really unique. And if I can call back any sort of crowd work in a joke, it just makes it a unique experience. I always like to wrestle with the crowd a little bit. Yeah, so I invite it.
So who's my single parent back there?
That's me.
That's you. Hi, you.
Hi.
What's your name?
Jamie.
Jamie. And how many kids do you have?
One.
You have one. How old?
Six.
I'm glad you're out. Yes. Right? Do you date very much?
Yes.
Well, that's good to know. Are you on a date tonight?
Yes.
I like how bold you are in saying that you date a lot in front of a date. That's why you're my queen.
As a fellow dog lover, I have to ask you about your dog intervention with your audience. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I'm in California, right? And so we have fire season like 11 months of the year. And every year, there's a story about somebody who dies because they go back into their fiery house trying to rescue their dog. And so I just started doing a bit where I talk to the audience. I talk to someone who swears they would do that, and I try to talk them out of it. And one of the tenets is that your dog is replaceable, which everyone chafes at. But my proof is that my dad had 5 black labs over the course of his lifetime named Pepsi.
5. When a Pepsi would die, my dad would go right to the pound and get a new Pepsi. He'd take the collar off the dead Pepsi. What are you moaning for? Collars cost money. And the information on the tags stays the same. Why do you want to waste my dad's money? Sometimes he wouldn't remember which Pepsi he was on. He forgot Pepsi 4 died once he thought Pepsi 5 lived 26 years.
We didn't think it was weird. Like, we just, I guess for us, when you have a black lab, you got to name it Pepsi.
Oh, yeah,
I don't know what people, I don't know why they don't. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and when I was a kid, we had 2 dogs in a row named Perky, so. There you go. Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, you get the sense of continuity, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. We had you on Beta once before, after your father passed, and after you wrote the touching and hilarious Dead People Suck. In Corset, you have a short bit about your mom moving in with you. Not long after this was recorded, your mother passed of COVID. Did you have any second thoughts about including this bit on the album?
Oh, no. I was relieved that I recorded the album while she was still alive. Because obviously I can't do that material when she's dead. I wouldn't have been able to fake that she was alive, you know.
I'm very stressed out, though. My living situation is stressful. I know why I have an aneurysm. My mother, my 81-year-old mother, moved in with me. It's temporary because she's 81. She wears a DNR bracelet, a do not resuscitate bracelet. I put it on her. She can't get it off. I hear her trying at night. chewing on it. Good luck, Mom. Dentures don't cut.
And I have a whole new chunk of material about her dying of COVID, which causes some consternation sometimes in front of some crowds, but I don't care.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about your final call with your mom?
So she died in June of 2020, and she died in California. And there happened to have been like a bit of a lull. So the hospital she was in left the iPad that was connected to our iPad, you know, like the one in her hospital room. They just left it on. So we had it on for like, I don't know, almost three straight days. So my sister and I, we slept in my room and, you know, we'd say goodnight to our mom and on the iPad and wake up and there she was. Definitely unconscious. I don't know how much she could hear us. But we just pretended like she could, and we talked to her, and we'd take the iPad around the house and just, you know, say what we were doing and all that kind of stuff. So that was the last call. It was 3 days long.
Yeah, 70 hours, I've read. Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty long. And, you know, the morning she passed, I was just watching her, and I noticed that her breaths were coming farther and farther apart, which is exactly what happened with my dad. My dad had died of cancer, and I was at his side when he stopped breathing. And it was one of those things where you're like, they take a breath, and then you're just instinctively waiting for the next one, and they don't take one, and then they take it, right? So the amount of seconds between each inhale, it gets longer and longer. And so that was happening to her. So then my sister and I just sort of perched ourselves right by the iPad in my kitchen and kind of watched, you know, until she didn't take a new breath. And then we're like, oh, okay, it happened. And after we finished reacting, I'm sure the hospital knew they were all hooked up, but we called them to let them know that she was gone.
Yeah. Your father had told you that he wanted to be cremated and have his ashes sprinkled in Ireland. So you and your son went there to do that. How did that go?
Well, it was a lot of fun. It was fun to go to Ireland. My dad had never gone. My dad was one of those Irish Americans that loved Ireland and never went. It's like, oh, you should have. I mean, and every old man in Ireland looked exactly like my dad. It was really jarring. But that was nice to see, too. I had gotten really into ancestry after my dad died. I wish I'd gotten into it when he was alive, because he would have enjoyed all the stuff I found out about his family. But, oh, well, you know, it was sort of an effort to connect with him, to look into ancestry and his ancestors. And ended up finding the stone ruin, like a little two-story house, very tiny house, that his great-grandmother was born in and had left during the early part of the famine with the whole family. They came to Albany, New York. And so we went there, my son and I, and that's where we sprinkled his ashes. Of course, it was in someone's private property, so we had to sneak onto it.
Well, as soon as we climbed over the fence, cows emerged from the grass. And they started walking over to us, right? And they looked very curious, like security cows. And then I realized, oh my God, they're not all cows. Some of them are bulls. And they're headed for us as well. And so my son and I went right back over the fence. And the bulls and the cows came right up to the very edge. One of the bulls mounted a cow while looking me directly in the eyes. And that's where we left my dad's ashes. A different way for the Kilmartin family to come full circle.
We actually got him on the stone rune. I don't say we do in the album, but we did get him there.
Oh, great. That's good to know. Any plans to return to Ireland with your mom's ashes or perhaps the ashes of all of your son's dead uncles?
You know, why not just deposit all of my family's remains in another country? I'm sure they wouldn't mind.
Yeah. Your mom doesn't
mind. I'm sure the Irish are happy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No,
yeah.
She comes from Luxembourgers who settled in Wisconsin. So
really?
We have a lot of ties to Wisconsin. Yeah.
Oh, so interesting.
I put her, my dad's ashes are also in a niche. I mean, there's a lot of ashes, right? So my sister got a hunk, I got a hunk, and then we have a hunk that we put in a niche. So most of my mom is in the niche with my dad. And then I have some that I still haven't figured out what to do with, but I want to do something I think would be meaningful to her when the pandemic's over and I can, you know, we can move and all that.
Very well said. Lori Kilmartin, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Coruscant. It's great.
Thank you so much.
Lori Kilmartin is a stand-up comedian and an Emmy-nominated writer. Her latest album is Coruscant. You can find out more about Lori at WPR.org/beta.
I don't think I'm ever going to have trouble coming up with ideas. I have an excess of ideas. It's really about figuring out which ideas are the ones that you're supposed to engage with.
Coming up, author Jamie Attenberg talks about her memoir, I Came All This Way to Meet You. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The thing with being a novelist, or really with any creative endeavor, is we have to willingly enter into the not knowing. We have to embrace that fact that there are myriad nuances to be unfolded. Characters we haven't met yet, actions we haven't invented, thousands upon thousands of words waiting to be chosen. If I know how a story ends when I start writing a book, I throw it aside. It's not worth writing if there are no surprises. When you slide down a mountain or jump off a cliff, you accept the not knowing. Don't tell me how it ends. Let me see for myself. The trick of life is understanding that even when we are simply standing to the side, as I did as a child near the ice, watching other people taking risks, we are engaging in the not knowing too. Everything is a risk. That's what's hitting so many people so hard right now, here, as we approach May 2020. They didn't know that they didn't know.
Jamie Attenberg is the New York Times best-selling author of 6 novels and 1 short story collection. She's probably best known for her novel, The Middlesteins. Jamie has shifted gears with her latest book. It's a memoir called I Came All This Way to Meet You, Writing Myself Home. The book uses free-flowing prose to take us inside the life of her mind. Jamie bravely shares the ups and downs of her life and the one constant throughout, her core identity as a writer.
Honestly, I never wanted to write a memoir. If you had asked me 3 years ago, I would have said, never, ever, ever would I do it. All of a sudden, I had all these stories that I wanted to tell. I was about to turn 50. I wanted to collect all my thoughts into one place, reflections especially on being a writer and an artist and a creative person, and see what I'd learned and kind of recognize the mistakes that I'd made and the lessons that I could glean from them. And it just made perfect sense at the time that I should suddenly start to write this thing, as it is with, you know, most creative projects that I start. It didn't seem like it made sense until it did.
I love the title of your memoir, I Came All This Way to Meet You, Writing Myself Home. Why did you choose these words for the title?
Well, I Came All This Way to Meet You is actually a sentence from the book that shows up late in the book, where I'm walking through an ossuary in Naples. There are a couple of moments in the book where I explore otherworldly places, cemeteries, ossuaries, catacombs, things like that, and think about ghosts and talk about ghosts. And this is really near the end of the book where I've arrived at this place in my life. You know, really, it only happened a few years ago. I was more peaceful. I was more calm at that moment. And I just was saying hi to the ghosts as I was walking through the ossuary. That was that moment. It popped out at me, that line, that it's, of course, the book is about finding myself too, and also finding all the people in my life that I love. And so it does a lot of work, that title.
It does, definitely. And it's a great title. I can't think of a better title for a memoir, really, to be honest. You tweeted that you're finding it so much more difficult to talk about memoir than your fiction because there are no characters to hide behind. Was it difficult for you to write your memoir because you had no characters to hide behind?
It's really tricky. Fiction is a great place for a person to hide. And the characters, you spend a lot of time getting to know them and you love them and hate them sometimes too. And it's easy to, you know, it's like gossiping about someone, which is one of my favorite things to do. I love to gossip. I think of fiction writing as just basically gossiping about characters. Hmm. So I can do that all day, really. But gossiping about myself is a different story.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. You have this very powerful paragraph about grief early on in your book. Could you please read it to us?
Grief can be forever. We are taught to seek closure in this country. We are encouraged to move on quickly. We are judged, possibly, for not getting over things fast enough. But grief can be for your whole life.
Thank you. If you don't mind my asking, how big a part has grief played in your own life?
Well, at that moment, what I'm writing about is the grief of my mother, who's lost her parents when she was young, and how that had sort of impacted me and how I watched her travel with it in her life. In a way, I haven't had that much to grieve. I mean, there have been losses in my life. Bad things have happened to me. I've witnessed bad things happen to other people. I've been really lucky, I think, really lucky that I haven't really lost people that are close to me. But I don't know. There's still things that I mourn. There's still things that I carry with me. But I think it's about exploring it. I spend a lot of time thinking, you know, I write through everything, whether it's in fiction or nonfiction. And I hope that I carry it well. I hope that I don't allow the sadness in my life to get in the way of me being the best version of myself.
Hmm. Yeah. You interviewed your father because you were trying to figure out why you are the way you are. What did you learn about him and about yourself from interviewing him?
He was a traveling salesman, and I grew up with him always being on the road and kind of being, you know, he was present in our lives, but he was always, you know, 3 days a week out there on the road, that kind of thing. And I guess I just wanted to know what he had learned from it and the hardships of it. I found that there were some commonalities between what was, you know, challenging about his job versus what's challenging about my job. Even just the, you know, the fact that he had to fly all the time, and I have spent a good portion of the past 10 years on the road myself, and how that can make you feel alone or distant or tired, or how physically exhausting it can be. I often think of myself as a traveling salesman, less so obviously during the pandemic, but with all the touring that I've done, you're always going out there and meeting people and shaking their hand and trying to sell them your book or yourself.
Mm-hmm. A therapist once told you that you are hardwired for anxiety. How did you react to that?
I found it quite a relief, actually. I think I was beating myself up for a really long time that I wasn't able to handle things. Because I'm, you know, I'm a pretty high-functioning person, right? I've written mm-hmm. a lot of books. I've traveled a lot. I can present myself in, you know, in public to people. I'm a good communicator. And this was the thing that I couldn't control. And I thought it was something that was really wrong with me, or that, like I said, or that it was my fault. And so it was a relief to hear that there was just something biological about it or chemical about it, and that my body did certain things when I was under stress, and there are ways to contend with that. And whenever I figure out what the problem is, I almost always have a sense of relief, because if there's a problem, then there's probably a solution.
Yeah. You believe that a creative person must arrive at an intersection of hunger and fear to make great art. How many times have you reached this intersection in your own work?
I think anytime I sit down to write a book, there's always this downtime before I start writing the next book, where I'm kind of collecting myself, building myself up. But also, whenever I'm not writing, I wish that I were writing. But also, you can't always be writing. Your brain needs rest. And then at some point, there's kind of this trigger moment where my brain is like, enough rest, I must write. I have to succeed. I have to be making something happen. I have to make my work happen. And that's kind of that hunger. And then the fear is just sort of like sitting still, your life stays exactly the same. I don't want my life to ever be too dull or too slow. I always want to be kind of in motion.
Hmm. You say that writing moments between mothers and daughters will always be your most beloved territory. Why?
I get a kick out of listening to mothers and daughters talk to each other. I definitely have a fun mom to talk to. She's very wry and she's very smart. But I think that mothers and daughters, from my perspective anyway, have a kind of closeness, a particular kind of closeness, and yet they challenge each other and they're like each other and yet can be, you know, different too. And I don't know, there's just, it's different than talking to a dad and it's different than talking to a sibling. It's, your mom kind of just knows you in a specific kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially your mom, as you mentioned, and also the fact that she told you that you can do anything that you want. I'm curious, is there a favorite moment of writing between mothers and daughters that you've written in any of your books?
You know, I love the mother and daughter and All Grown Up. I have them, like, if I ever were to write a part two of that book, it would just be the two of them driving cross country together. Mm. Like, I just got a kick out of their vibe, their back and forth vibe. There's like a scene in my last novel, All This Could Be Yours, where the mother and the daughter in that book are kind of eating bad food in a kitchen and driving in a car together. And there's all these family secrets they're talking about. And again, there's like, you know, they're just sort of giving a little bit and not a lot, but there's a lot underneath the dialogue. I love that a lot. The Middlesteins, Edie Middlestein is a classic Jewish mother in my mind. The way she talks to everyone, I love. Actually, I've been working on this new novel and I kind of have the mother off screen and I woke up in the, you know, for most of the book and then she's going to kind of show up at a climactic moment. And I woke up in the middle of the night and I was like, she needs to be more present in the book.
Hmm. Yeah. You moved from New York to New Orleans 5 years ago. Why?
I lived in New York for a really long time and it was really where I came of age, but it wasn't where I wanted to live out the rest of my life. And I had been going to New Orleans in the winter for a couple of years, for probably about 3 months a year. And it was just, you know, my happy place. And I wondered what it would be like to make my happy place my full-time place and to see how it made me feel and to see what that looked like. And I really had been thinking about where I wanted to be when I was 50. And now I'm here and I'm 50.
That's great to hear. And when you were living in New York City, you experienced a lot of housing instability, right? You were moving an incredible number of times over a very short period of time.
Yeah, there was 1 year in particular, actually 10 years ago, where I couldn't afford my apartment in New York anymore, so I sublet it. And I was couch surfing all over the country, in the city too, and I would find a place to stay for a couple of weeks. I did come down to New Orleans and I stayed here because I found a cheap place to live for a couple months. That was my first time really spending time down in the city. And it was not a fun time in my life at all. It was right before my fourth book came out and it was just a really challenging time in my life. Housing instability it's a huge crisis in this country. And I was lucky that I had people to look out for me at that time. It was a humbling experience.
In your book, you write that you're never short of ideas in New York City. Is that still the case in New Orleans? Or no trouble coming up with ideas there?
I don't think I'm ever going to have trouble coming up with ideas. I have an excess of ideas. It's really about figuring out which ideas are the ones that you're supposed to engage with for me.
Mm-hmm. Is that tricky?
Yeah, it takes a while. You want to make sure that it's worth your time. Sometimes I do have false starts with books where I'll write 50 pages of one book and then think that's not the best use of my time. That's not the direction that I need to be going in. Sometimes I write 50 pages to meet one character and then pluck that character and put it into another book.
Yeah, I've read in some of your craft talks, you talked about how you have this period sort of getting acquainted with the characters and thinking about them and they don't come to you immediately. You have to develop them and kind of spend time with them before you commit them to paper?
I sometimes write conversations between two characters that I know I'll never use and just let them go talk for a while. I remember for All Grown Up, I had two characters just talk about all the drugs they'd ever done in their lives, like drug experiences for, I don't know, pages and pages. And I never used any of it at all. But when I was done, I was like, oh, I know who they are. And not only that, I know how they feel about each other. They were able to be kind of like funny about it and vulnerable about it. And I think it's the same, you know, all of these topics, it's like the same as setting characters down to have a meal together or having characters have sex, as I said before, or, you know, just vulnerable human moments, putting your characters together, seeing what happens, what comes out of it, knowing that it's okay if you don't use it. It's okay if you throw it away, that this is an exercise that you need to go through in order to get to the truth of these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. What have you learned about yourself from writing I Came All This Way to Meet You?
Oh my gosh. Okay, you're only the second person to ask me that. And the first time I was like, I don't know. No, but I do know. I did realize that I like myself a little bit more than I thought I did. That was kind of a big revelation. Like, I looked at the end and I thought, all right, I've made all these mistakes. I'm not a terrible person. I'm at least an okay person. And that was important for me to realize that I had done some okay things with my life too, and that I'd accomplished things. And that wasn't why I set out to write the book at all. I wrote the book because I had these stories inside of me that I was dying to tell. That's why I write any book, is because it's in me and it has to get out. It's not a cathartic moment. It's just I feel a little bit more comfortable with myself after writing this book.
Well, that's good. But in my humble opinion, I think you're selling yourself short. You should think of yourself as more than an okay person. But I mean, that's progress. Maybe another memoir would get you, you know, maybe that would help. But yeah. Jamie Attenberg, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. And congratulations on I Came All This Way to Meet You, Writing Myself Home.
Thank you for having me.
Jamie Attenberg is the author of the memoir, I Came All This Way to Meet You, Writing Myself Home. You can find out more about Jamie at wpr.org/beta.
The last 10 minutes of Head are almost like a kind of a download of information.
Coming up, we look back at the 1968 Monkees movie Head with Michael Nesmith and Peter Mills. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Okay, take nine.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
One of my favorite films is the Monkees' 1968 feature film, Head. It's one of the weirdest movies I've ever seen, which is probably why it's also one of my favorites. It features some of the Monkees' best songs and includes the film debut of the one and only Terry Garr. Head was a box office flop. Yet here we are more than 50 years after its release, and its cultural influence continues to grow. So says Peter Mills. He's the author of The Monkees, Head, and the 60s. He joins us in just a moment. But first, a special treat. I was lucky enough to talk to the late Michael Nesmith about our mutual love of the movie Head. Here's what he had to say.
Well, let me ask you, was it disappointing to you when you walked in there and saw this thing, this movie called Head? Did it disappoint you, your expectations?
No, it didn't, but I know that it did a lot of other people's, especially the core fan base. No, I think partly because I was in my early 20s by then, and I sort of was drawn to avant-garde literature and films.
That's good to hear, because I loved it. I loved making it. I had such a good time with Bob and Jack, and it was the high point of my whole Monkees experience.
Yeah.
And I think it lives on well beyond the television shows. I mean, the television shows have their place, but it lives on like the music lives on. It stands on its own 3 feet.
Yeah, very much so.
Or 12 feet or whatever they are. It has a life that comes from literature. It has a life that comes from fiction. It has a life that comes from fancy and the deep troves of, well, how do I say it, of making up stories and narrative.
Yeah.
So it was telling a narrative, but the narrative that it was telling was very, very different than the one the television show was.
This is some of the best music, I think, that you guys recorded is in Head, and especially you, Mickey, Peter, and Davey performing a live version of your song, Circle Sky. There's just so much energy and rawness in that performance. It strikes me as kind of a prototype of punk rock. What do you remember about filming that performance?
Well, Bob and to a degree Jack were really curious about how to stage it and how to make it have a beat inside the movie that was consistent with the other beats that they were creating. So you had to add something on the screen. You couldn't just wave the camera around like Ken Kesey had done on the bus further and expect something to come out of it. So they wrote up this idea that the crowd came forward at the end of the performance and began to rip our clothes off, only to find out that beneath the clothes were dummies put up there as a kind of a the mannequins that had been put up there as a falsity, and that there wasn't anything to it, and that was all fine. That all kind of harked back to the television show and the time that it was coming to be. But what happened, what was really, really happening, was that that record was the Monkees performing. Mm-hmm. That was the way the three of us sounded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, David played a little bit of organ on it for it to fit into the film, but he was part of the ensemble in a way that a real band comes together. And Circle Sky was really us in the garage just playing as loud as we could play and singing as loud as we could sing. And the song was a song that I had written about, you know, the whole experience. And it was actually the Monkees' performance. For me, it was one of the most powerful moments in the movie because it's like, that's it. That's the real thing. What you're seeing there is what we did as a band that never intended to be a band.
Peter Mills is senior lecturer in media and popular culture at Leeds Beckett University in Leeds, England. He's also the author of The Monkees, Head, and the 60s. Does Peter agree that Bob Rafelson set out to deconstruct and destroy the Monkees' TV image by making the movie?
The film, if you've seen it, it begins and ends with a jump from a bridge. And one of the big themes of the film is escape and persecution. Throughout the film, the Monkees are kind of attacked and pursued and reviled by all sorts of people. That theme of wanting to escape themselves is very strong in the movie. Even right at the end, you think, ah, finally they've done it. But the film plays one last sort of cruel joke on them.
Yeah. The actor Jack Nicholson co-wrote the screenplay for Head with Rafelson, and the story goes that Nicholson structured the script along the lines of an acid trip. Do you agree with that?
Well, I mean, it has some of that kind of, what should we say, pharmaceutical logic to it. I also, to me, it's more like something like Alice in Wonderland, which I know also has a sort of lysergic aspect to it. You simply where one scene blossoms out of another rather than a formal structured narrative. The roots of the film, actually, in the screenplay were in a sort of a long weekend that the Monkees and Bob Rafelson and Jack Nicholson, a couple of other people, Brendan Cahill, spent in a hotel in Ojai in California, just kind of free associating under the influence of various substances, I believe, for a weekend. And Nicholson wrote it down, and that was his kind of core document, if you like, that he kind of, him and Bob Rafelson spun the screenplay out of.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the beginning of Head. It has to be one of the most beautiful marriages of visuals and music in a film, in my opinion. It's that scene when Mickey Dolenz jumps off the Gerald Desmond Bridge and we hear the opening chords of the Porpoise Song, the Jerry Goff and Carole King composition. Can you talk about this scene?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's an absolutely remarkable thing, one of my favourite moments in cinema, really. As I was saying earlier, you know, the Monkees are being chased across this bridge. And it's just Mickey, actually, in the first scene that jumps. And he jumps off the bridge, and you see this figure falling. And just for a few precious seconds, there's just silence, actually. There's just kind of the wind song. And then the first chords of the Porpoise Song strike up. And and you see the figure falling, and just as the figure who we believe to be Mickey hits the water, the song breaks. Absolutely exquisite, but it's also awful too, because you know we've just seen somebody jump off the bridge and hit the water.
Mm-hmm. The Diddy Diego song really makes it clear that Head is not going to be a 90-minute version of the Monkees TV show. As you say, it is in itself a kind of grotesque graffiti across the early Monkee image. How so?
If you listen to the Diddy Diego thing, you'll hear that it's a kind of a skit on the Monkees theme, you know.
Hey, hey, we are the Monkees. You know we love to please. A manufactured image with no philosophies.
We hope you like our story, although there isn't one. That is to say, there's many. That way there is more fun.
It is very honest, actually, because it's saying to the audience, well, here we are. You can like us if you want. If you don't like us, that's fine. So it sounds like a kind of slightly freaky rap, actually. It's, you know, it's sort of chanted by the four of them rather than sung. When I first heard that when I was a kid, just on this album which I'd found, I was thinking, well, what's this then? I thought, you know, they were too busy singing to put anybody down, and now there's this thing. What's going on?
Exactly, yeah. I want to ask you about one of my favorite scenes in the film is the factory scene with Inspector Shrink. Can you walk us through this scene?
In that particular scene, it's made sort of explicit that, you know, the Monkees are a product and that they're involved in the industrial production of culture, and culture which has a life cycle. And, you know, the expectation is you might get sort of 2 or 3 years and then somebody else comes along. I mean, that's the traditional sort of model.
A new world, its only preoccupation will be how to amuse itself. The tragedy of your times, my young friends, is that you may get exactly what you want.
When I'm teaching this, when I'm talking about this stuff in the class with my students, we talk about some kind of fairly hardcore cultural theory of people like Theodore Adorno and Walter Benjamin. But it's that idea of culture as an industrial product. If you've seen the film, you'll remember the image of the box. The Monkees themselves get trapped in a box. It becomes a big sort of theme towards the second half of the film. But in that factory scene, the factory is producing boxes, each of which has a logo of the black box on it. So, you know, it's really visually sort of reinforced. And that's one of the examples where this film really, really, if anybody's seen it before and they thought, what on earth was that? I'm never going near that again. Go back and have another look, because it really repays repeat viewing, because you start to see the connections between these apparently totally random scenes that don't seem to have anything to do with each other.
Yeah, it seems to me that the idea of this black box serves as probably the most important metaphor in Head. There's a scene later on in the film where the Monkees find themselves trapped in a big black box, and Davy takes charge of the situation.
I'll show you how to get out of this box. You want to get out of this box? This is how you get out.
Well, interestingly enough, the original script, which I've seen, there are four ways to get out of that box. And each Monkee has a way of getting out of the box. But again, the box is part metaphor and part reality, a bit like the Monkees themselves in a way, because on set, infamously, there was a box that the Monkees used to sit in between scenes, the idea being that they sort of wouldn't get into trouble, or they wouldn't just sort of disappear off set or start drinking, or whatever it was that they might do, which would sort of interfere with the extraordinarily tight production schedules that they were all obliged to work to. So that box, fantastical as it seems in the film, is sort of kissing cousin of something which was actually on the set. But as you also rightly say, it's a metaphor. It's about their entrapment. It's about how do we navigate our way out of being the Monkees, actually.
Let's talk about Davy's song and dance performance of the Harry Nilsson composition, Daddy's Song. This is another highlight of the film, I think. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting because it was filmed twice, one with Davy wearing kind of a white-on-black outfit, sort of tuxedo, and then filmed again where he's filming a black-on-white outfit. as his partner in the dance, who also choreographed it, Tony Basil, whose name might be familiar to people. There was a black and white version and a white and black version. And incredibly, Ray Fulson and his team manually edited the two together. So when you see the routine, and it's doing this almost sort of subliminal cutting between the two versions, the two outfits.
One of my favorite moments in Head occurs right after Davey finishes Daddy's Song. What happens?
Well, the lights come up and there's sort of begrudging applause. This is another thing, you know, fits in with the theme of the film. Often the monkeys are either ignored or they're treated badly. And here's an example of that. There's sort of like a, as I say, grudging applause, which is a sort of like slow hand clap. Mm-hmm. And Davey comes out of the soundstage miraculously in a different outfit. And yeah. He encounters somebody leading a cow, and that somebody's Frank Zappa.
The song was pretty white.
Well, so am I. What can I tell you?
You've been working on your dancing, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've been rehearsing it. Glad you noticed that.
Yeah, it doesn't leave much time for your music. You should spend more time on it because the youth of America depends on you to show the way.
Yeah?
Zappa is credited as the critic. But I always think it's rather marvellous how Davey responds. You know, he doesn't rise to the criticism or sort of the inferred reduction in Zappa's estimation of Davey's singing and dancing and so on. But it's an unexpected encounter, certainly. But Zappa was already sort of in the monkey's orbit because he was a friend of Michael Nesmith's and actually appeared in one of the last episodes.
You say that, quote, there is more information in the last 10 minutes of this movie than most others pack into 2 hours. Head simply does not behave like any other movie you've ever seen, unquote. Can you elaborate on that?
I'm just listening back to it now, and I do. It's a bold claim, but I think I do still stand by that.
Good.
Partly because the closing sections of the film are a sort of, what should we say, an accelerated resume of everything that's gone before, but they're going backwards. The last 10 minutes of the film kind of reverses everything. And so they sort of end up back on the bridge where they started. But I also think that each of those sections, so there's like a silent movie section, there's a romantic comedy section, there's a Western section, there's a monster movie section, etc., etc., is all kind of packed into that last phase of Head. It's almost as though it's like looking for the right shape for the idea. Which of these available genres is going to help us tell this story? And so it touches upon loads and loads of them, and none of them quite manage it. So maybe this kind of kaleidoscopic melange, which psychedelia and the tropes surrounding psychedelia are very well equipped to present, at least visually. Maybe that's the way to do it. So the last 10 minutes of Head are almost like a kind of a download of information. I guess that's one way of putting it in a sort of contemporary sense. The movie doesn't tell us what to think at all.
There are a lot of people, a lot of musicians who are big fans of Head, and you have blurbs from them
sure.
on the back cover of your book. Andy Partridge of XTC,
yeah.
Bill Drummond from the KLF.
Yeah.
Do you think Head has had a cultural influence at all?
I think it was Chairman Mao. You didn't expect me to quote him, did you?
No, I did
saying
not.
Saying about the French Revolution, when somebody said, well, what do you think is the impact of the French Revolution? This was about 1960, and he said, oh, it's too soon to know. And I think with Head, I think its cultural relevance and its influence is actually growing. Hmm. At the time of its release, it was an absolute 100% belly flop failure. Peter Tork said that it died a death you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. That was how he described Head's initial commercial performance. But pretty much since the end of the Monkees and the early 70s, interest in the film has grown and grown and grown. And I think it's going to continue to grow because there's so much in there, and it's incredibly, it becomes truer the older it gets. I don't know how that happens, but some of the themes are become more and more relevant rather than historical.
Peter Mills, thank you very much for taking time to talk to us. And thank you for helping me develop an even stronger appreciation for Head.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Peter Mills is the author of The Monkees, Head, and the 60s. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Laurie Kilmartin, Jamie Attenberg, and Peter Mills. If you want to hear it again or catch up on past episodes, click over to Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast catcher and click subscribe, follow, and like. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I'm starting to think you just like riling people up.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Why would he charge us for free snacks?
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
What does that mean? I need media training.
Quick, suck it before the venom reaches my heart.
Okay, I will.